Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the After Show with Mackenzie Stewart and Amy Shannon. We have over 15 years of literary experience between us. Our mission is to educate and assist authors of all writing levels. As you all know, I am the co-host of, the After Show. I have with me Amy Shannon here today. She is a little under the weather, but we give Amy an A for effort for coming out and not feeling well. So, Amy, I jumped in there to cover your part of the script just because I know you're having some difficulties. Well, hello.
Hello, and thank you very much. Yes, this cough just won't go away.
Oh my goodness. So we're definitely wanting a speedy recovery for you, but we have an action-packed, hour today on the show. So I'm ready to jump in and get started with our guest tonight. Well, we have with us today Richard Martin. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we are so tickled and delighted that you decided to join us today and talk
yes.
about your work. So one of the things that we like to do, we like for all of our authors to tell us a little bit about themselves and then how you started, telling stories. Tell us how you started telling stories, and then we're going to jump into your work you want to promote tonight.
Yes. Well, thank you again for having me. I've been writing a long time. I'm 77 years old, and this is my first published novel. I have other novels in the pipeline that are done and ready to go. But
congratulations.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say congratulations.
And,
you're welcome.
Thank you. And my first live interview as well.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of firsts today.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
I'm a little anxious, but I'm sure once I start blabbing that I'll relax. And I'm very grateful to, in one sense, it's like, what's wrong with this picture? Somebody who's been writing a long time and is 77 and only now is having his first published novel. On the other hand, looking at my life, it's happened just exactly the way that it was supposed to happen for me. I've always had that faith. I've had that confidence in my writing, but I almost had a previous book published in 2008-2009 with McAdam Cage, a pretty well respected little independent in San Francisco, right during the recession, and McAdam Cage went bankrupt shortly after and took my book with it. It wasn't officially published by them, thank God, but I've had just enough successes with short stories published in literary journals. Originally poems were published. Just enough success or victories to keep me going, to keep me writing, to keep that confidence alive. And I've always said, even before Regal House Publishing, I want to mention them and Jeannie and Pam. They're my angels. I love that house so much, and them and their work. Even before they wrote to me and said, yes, we want to publish your book, Oranges from Magellan, I have come to such a point in my life with those little successes, with overall failure, I'm not ashamed to say. I love writing so much that I would have kept writing anyway, right to the end, as long as my mind is, still clear and I can say what's going on inside me. I just love writing. I'm not a tortured writer. I'm a happy writer, and I'm even more happy now to have this published. I'm married. I've been married to my wife, Paris, for 27 years. This will be 27. What else? I guess not to go into the book early, but a theme of the book is certainly father-son relationships, and the great event in my life was my father suddenly dying when I was 13. He was 44. And that kind of, that informs most of my stories, that sense of loss, that sense of longing, that sense of what is life mean? What does the world mean? What is this thing called death? Where did it come from? And Joe is having lost it. Joe Magellan, the protagonist, having lost his father. There are a lot of similarities between my life and the book. Not all. I've never wanted to break the world record for flagpole sitting, and I've never sat on it, and I've never gone up on a flagpole. But just that whole idea of, both being separate from the world, and yet somehow feeling like that is the way to enter more deeply into the world. Another important part of my life is my sobriety. I got sober at 40. I've been sober for 36 years. It helped me write in the beginning, and then at the end it was keeping me from writing, and I just had to get sober with help, both for my sanity and for my writing, because I just really couldn't write anymore. I was drinking and I wasn't writing.
Congratulations on being sober that long.
Thank you. I'll stop there.
I know it's...
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I know that it's one day at a time, but thank you for sharing that part of your life with us.
Yes, it's a crucial, essential part of my life. I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't be having the book published. I wouldn't be talking to you. I probably wouldn't be alive, or if I was, I would be locked up somewhere if I hadn't stopped.
Well, we're glad you're here with us and sharing your work.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, thank you so much for sharing. And, in all of our lives, we are sharing a piece of us as we're writing. Not everything in our books are true. Well, when I say true, not something that we want to do, but I do think that the way that you are connecting with your readers through your loss, and I'm sure they can feel it also, as they're reading the words, as the words are coming off the page for them, and you are offering someone some comfort in the stories that you're telling.
I think so. That's my that's my aim.
Yeah. So tell me this. And you told us a lot of wonderful information about yourself, Ian. That's what this is really all about. We want our audience to really connect with you, the writer, so that they can follow you through your many, many different works, no matter if it's a poem or a short story. But we really definitely want them to follow you and connect with you. So what advice, because we do have people who listen, some are published authors, some have published just one piece of work. Some of them may have stopped. Some of them may just be lost. What should I write next? You've been writing for a long time, and I consider, your short stories being published in journals. I still, consider that as being published. What keeps you going? What keeps you writing? What keeps you telling stories?
Well, first, as I say, just the love of writing. You know, when I first started writing, I wrote poems that were just very dense and incomprehensible, probably. I loved Dylan Thomas and Gerard Manley Hopkins, who were very dense poets, very lyrical and dense. And words, I've always loved words just by themselves. The poems that I wrote were more drunk on words than really concerned with getting some kind of message across or moving somebody in one way or another. And when I moved to short stories, it kind of expanded, kind of allowed me to relax a little bit and become less lyrical, less word obsessed, and more concerned with the story, with the characters. And I had a nice number of, as I say, enough stories published to keep me going. I'm not a really ambitious person, but everybody wants to have their work seen and enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that my stories kept getting longer, and that put me into novels. Probably in direct answer to your question, what keeps me going is picking a topic that is bigger than me, that contains a mystery, such as Joe with his flagpole sitting, and a lot of the book is about why he's up there. And, of course, he's up there for many reasons. But it's kind of like life intrudes on his effort to break the world record. It's not really about the world record. That's an important hook to keep people reading, you know, to find out whether he breaks it or not, which I won't reveal. And don't be sure that you know which way it goes. But it's I want to get lost in the mystery, not mystery in the sense of who killed who, but mystery in the sense of the mystery of life, the mystery of why we do things that we do, the mystery of being a human being on this rock that's hurtling through outer space, and you know what, and as an individual, what am I as an individual supposed to be doing in the world with my time, with this blessed gift of being? And for me, it was obvious pretty early on that it was to write. I actually started writing letters is what I wrote first. I was away at Berkeley for a year, and then I was in the Army in Germany for 18 months. I didn't have a lot of friends. I felt I was very lonely. And my letters back home to my mother, my three sisters, my friends, male friends, a girlfriend, all not only kept me going to connect, that's probably the one word answer to your question, is to connect with other people. I was able to develop kind of different personalities writing letters to different individuals. I wrote different letters to my mother, reassuring her I was okay in the Army and so on, then compared to how sarcastic and cynical I was writing back and forth with my friends. So I kind of developed the ability to not pretend to be different characters, but to actually be different characters within myself through those letters. But what keeps me going now is picking a topic that I just immediately connect with. I read an article in the paper about this guy who went up on a flagpole. He was actually a minister, and he was going to kind of start a church there up on top of the flagpole, I guess, I don't know, with a bullhorns like Joe uses. And he also had his wife was running a cafe at the bottom of the flagpole. The article was about him getting the pole. We had these vicious Santa Ana winds that we have here in Southern California, and it knocked the pole over and broke his leg and put him in the hospital. And so I was completely fascinated with this story. I called, I looked up in the phone book, this is how long ago the genesis of the story is. I looked up in the flag in the phone book and called this gentleman's wife and to talk to her, to find out about what was why he went up there and if he was okay and so on. I don't remember a lot of the conversation except that I said, is he gonna go back up after he gets out of the hospital? And she said, not if I have anything to say about it. So that was the genesis of the story. And it was just this mystery of, like, when I see, you know, articles or stories about people who do the strangest things, you know, like build a cabin out of, you know, tin cans or something more magical or mysterious, like paint full paintings on a flat rock, or that's what they do with their life. And things like that have always interested me. And I relate to those things. I'm kind of normal in one sense, but in another way, I feel like a stranger in the world. And I know that most people at one time or another feel that same strangeness. And that's what the book is about. That's kind of my ideal reader, is somebody who gets that. And of course, there's a lot of humor in what I write too. It's not glum stuff. I don't know if that answers the question or not.
Yes. It did. Yes, it definitely did. So let's kind of, I like the way that you intertwined your answer to the book. And so let's officially get into the book so we can, learn a little bit more about the character. So tell us the name of the book.
Oranges for Magellan.
All right. And tell us, you know, an overview of what the book is about.
Well, it's about this guy. He's at the time the book starts, he's 35. He's a substitute teacher. He's unsatisfied with his life, unfulfilled. He's married to Clover. They've been married for 10, 11 years. They have a 10-year-old son named Nate Nathaniel. And it's an unhappy family, not really anything radically dysfunctional except that his obsession with breaking the world record for flagpole sitting, which is 444 days, so he has to sit up there for 445 days to break the record, that obsession and his failure to fulfill it, he's had I think it's 7 previous attempts in which he lasts no longer than a week or two and gets down for various reasons because he just can't handle it up there being by himself, I think, is the main reason. And so the book opens with him graduating from Dr. Malcolm Carriage's Obsession Seminar, which is a kind of all kinds of people with all kinds of obsessions go to this 6-weekend seminar to get cured of their obsessions. And it opens with him at the graduation night for this seminar, in which he and a number of other people are graduating for their different obsessions. And so he's cured, and Clover, his wife, thinks finally we will have a normal life like other normal human beings. And he's reluctantly gone along with the program because he's kind of accepted that he's not going to be able to do it, so he might as well get the obsession out of his system. Well, the obsession really isn't out of his system. They go to the zoo the next day to celebrate. On the way home, they stop at a little kind of a hole in the wall. Clover doesn't want to stop. Nate doesn't want to stop, but for some reason, Joe wants to stop. Well, he spotted out in front this massive flagpole. And that's all it took to trigger him to think, I really need to try this one more time. And that's the door through which they walk for the remainder of the book as he does attempt that to break that record one more time. And just as when I started the book, many other things happened, regardless of what my plan was in the beginning, many other things happened that I hadn't planned that were wonderful. And just as Joe going up the pole, or just as all of us with our plans of, what is it, the plans of mice and men and women that are always interrupted by life itself. So that's what the book is about.
That's great. That's great. Is there an excerpt that you would like to read?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah. I write a lot of dialogue, but dialogue is kind of hard to read, you know, because you lose track of who's saying what. And Joe, when he's up there, he writes a journal, and this excerpt is from the journal. He started writing it. This is his second day up, I believe, and he starts writing this journal. So not too long. There was a big brouhaha when he first went up. There was a traffic jam below, and he drew a lot of attention. And on the second day, nobody's there. So that's kind of the state of mind that Joe is in when he begins this. My adoring fans have forgotten me already. My 15 seconds were fun. Time to get serious. Time to buckle down. I need a proper desk up here. A man needs a desk. I leaned on the banister, digging the low light on the green hills. A long shadow on the sidewalk caught my eye. It was 6 or 7 store lengths. I shifted from elbow to elbow, and it moved. I realized it's me. It was me trying to figure out what my shadow was. They're holding parades for the book also takes place at the in 1981 and 1982, right after the hostages were freed in Iran. So that's this reference. They're holding parades for the hostages all over the country. Celebrate, but don't look too far back into history. The past is hungry and will eat your patriotism alive. The wash and dry system I have will do, but 445 days without a shower is daunting. Clover could haul me up a hose. I could soap up and blast myself off like a horse. She found a great lightweight pop-up curtain rig, kind of like they use around manholes, in which I perform my ablutions. I don't know what a story means. This is kind of in reference to his being a substitute English teacher. Mm-hmm. I don't know what a story, and also what the, really in reference to the book itself and the mystery of the pole. I don't know what a story means. There, I said it. Throw me out of teacher world. That's what they want. What does it mean? I get lost in the story, as in the woods. What do the woods mean? The meaning is a primal force. The meaning the writer intends might not be the true meaning at all. The subconsciousnesses of writer and reader are at play together, beyond reason, out of control. Those young wolves, his students, sensed I was pretending to know what a teacher is supposed to know. They watched my dread of being found out leak like blood through my white shirt. Persian rugs for sale. One a white tiger on a chain-link fence by a vacant lot up a block where a company of homeless people gather with shopping carts and makeshift shelter every night and by morning are gone like ghosts. Sun's Liquor, Grand Motel, Laundromat, Post Office with Old Flag, Galore Nails, day laborers outside house and home leaning down to every leaving driver. William Golding said of Lord of the Flies, I felt a tremendous visual force behind the whole book. How do you teach that? How do you learn it? How do you read it? I'm going to make up my own theory, the new theory of literature as unknowable. A tiny weed with one pink flower pokes up from a crack right in the middle of the sidewalk. Hard to be a flower in the city. I need to lose myself in teaching as I lose myself in reading. I'm asking them to lose themselves. I'll stand up there in the middle of a cloud of unknowing and declare, nobody can tell you what this means, this story, these people, this life. Find out, decide for yourself. Crash the state of wonder. Then the parents storm the classroom. How dare you tell my kid to think for himself? He's got to get into college and feed us in our old age. Don't be so fancy. Just tell him what the damn story means. I'll be happy to see spring, sleep without long johns. I dare to believe I can do this. It's easier to believe the impossible might happen than it is to believe the probable is all there is. The probable is not a happy place to live. And that's the end of his little journal entry.
That's wonderful. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
You mentioned you enjoy writing. You write more dialogue. Tell me a little bit about that. You like to write more dialogue so people can feel the characters.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If I had one thing that I love to do is eavesdrop. Mm-hmm. You know, just listen to even the most mundane conversations between human beings. It's just, you know, I love the music of language, and I think the music of language is most often expressed in people talking, because they, even if they're trying to hide what they mean or where they're at, they reveal it in the way that they talk. And I love to listen to people talk. I love to talk myself, obviously. And I just love the music of language. I've always loved the music of language. The music of words.
I can relate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's,
I write a lot of dialogue myself.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to, I use it when I pop open a book, I'll make sure that it's not just dense description or narrative. I love to see those breaks where there's a lot of white space and a lot of conversation between the characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a lot of the story can be told in the conversation. So we can find out a lot about the characters through what is actually being said, and also conveying how they're feeling by the dialogue as well. So
sure, and hiding a lot of, I'd say if one of my themes in writing is miscommunication, is how, so if we communicated clearly and simply and honestly, probably 98% of the things that are said wouldn't have to be said. There would be a lot more silence in the world. But we hide, you know, we hide on purpose. We hide involuntarily because we don't want to reveal who we are for, you know, various fears or expectations, you know. And like I say, what I said about letters and being kind of different characters for different people that I'm writing to, the same with people who I talk to. But I'm not pretending, I'm not putting on a mask so much as I'm just using one part of myself that fits into that particular situation with that particular, you know, to find a common language. That's what's important to me. And that's kind of what I'm aiming at. You know, they say we either afflict the comfortable or comfort the afflicted. I'm more comfort the afflicted. I'm not so much, if you've read the book, you know, there's not a lot of politics or not a lot of overt politics in there. I'm not.
Right?
I mean,
I just started reading it, so
yeah.
You'll have my review within the next couple weeks.
Oh, good. Wonderful.
Hey, I want to thank you so much for joining the show. Tell the audience the name of the book again and where they can find it.
Okay, the title is Oranges for Magellan, and you can find it everywhere. You can find it, search for orange, do a Google for Oranges for Magellan. It'll pop up. The first one will be Amazon. The second one will be Barnes & Noble. I don't know that it's in those, in stores so much as it's available. And also through, if you want to spend a couple extra bucks to buy it from my publisher, my wonderful independent publisher, Regal House Publishing. And it's available in softcover and ebook. And also you can get a little bit more expensive hardcover but only at the Regal House Publishing. So it's everywhere. And I hope people buy it and enjoy it. Have a good time.
Oh, yes, that is great. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today and sharing your work. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Amy, I hope you are feeling a little better.
I'm here.
Yeah, we're going to move on to our second half hour with our guests on. And so we have, who do we have on today?
Hi,
this is Rich Hostick.
Hi, Rich. How's it going?
It's going great. We also have my writing partners, Arnold and Lloyd.
Hi there.
Arnold, are you there?
Yep.
And I'm here too.
All right. Well, welcome to the show. If you all could just spend a few minutes telling the audience, who you are and how did you come to write a book together. So perhaps we can go through the introductions for each co-author, and then we can go into how did this relationship blossom into a book.
Yeah, let me start off. I'll introduce myself, and then if Arnold could answer that question, he's probably the best one to take that one on. So this is Rich Hosek. I am a novelist currently. I previously worked as a television writer and have been writing short stories and stuff like that my whole life. And Arnold and I used to be writing partners in television as well.
Yeah.
Lloyd?
And
all right. Well, I can go. Arnold, you want to go ahead?
Yeah. So this is Arnold Rudnick, and as Rich so eloquently put together, he and I met in college and worked on films together and teamed up to write. And also, while I was a writer, I worked at Paramount Pictures and did research for the Motion Picture Group. And when I was tasked with finding the expert in the paranormal for a project that was being developed, I was pretty good at my job, and I found Lloyd Auerbach, who's a preeminent parapsychologist in the Bay Area. And so Lloyd and I began, a work relationship, but quickly became friends, and at one point decided we wanted to create a project. And long story short, that project began and Rich and I were teaming up and getting jobs writing. And so the three of us all worked together to create what was at the time PsyCops or Rainy and Day's Supernatural Sleuths. And we had some producers interested, and their responses they got was nobody wants to do paranormal. And then so it didn't sell, and then X-Files came out. So this all was before the X-Files, and we had a paranormal investigator and a cop. We had a male-female team looking into the unknown. And so X-Files is a tremendous, show. So there was nowhere to take this for the decade of X-Files. And after all of our, you know, continued careers, Rich, you know, pulled it out and said, hey, I'd like to novelize this script. And so he novelized the script into the first book in the series, Near Death, that Lloyd and I were excited to see happen and also to be invited, you know, participate with Rich. And then, you know, now to see a second book, and there's more books planned in the series, we're just excited that Nate Rainey and Jennifer Day have come to life.
And I'm Lloyd Auerbach. I am a parapsychologist and author myself. I write, well, most of my books other than these two are actually nonfiction. The majority of them are around the paranormal. I'm kind of known to be a ghost hunter, ghost buster kind of guy, but in reality, I'm kind of a generalist in the field of parapsychology and an educator. I actually teach courses through Atlantic University. I teach an online graduate school course, and then I teach a lot of courses for the general public through the Ryan Research Center, which is the longest running laboratory in the country. It's the legacy lab from Duke University from so long ago. So I've written a number of books, like I said, 9 books on the paranormal and 1 on self-publishing and promotion, and working on some other stuff as well. So I'm also a psychic entertainer, mentalist, former magician, alongside this kind of a parallel career to it all, just kind of giving me a little extra understanding of how people sometimes mislabel things as paranormal when in fact they're not.
What's an example of something?
Something like that?
Yes.
Sure. Well, a good example, actually, I think, has been what's been going on with the pandemic. There were some surveys done by a couple of real estate companies or companies looking at real estate at homeowners throughout the pandemic, especially during the lockdowns. And there was an increase in people reporting that their homes were haunted. In fact, it was a huge increase, bigger numbers we've ever seen before. But in reality, the majority of those kinds of reports, what people were reporting, were unusual noises and sensations that they might have picked up in their home, which really had explanation. They just had never been in their home for 24 hours a day for so many days in a row and never
right.
noticed things.
Right. Oh, no,
yeah, maybe there was a ghost there, too. There might have been a ghost there here and there, just decided, oh, I'm getting tired of these people. I think I'll play with them a little bit. But that's pretty unlikely.
Right.
Yeah, there's another great example in the book, too. Our main character at the beginning investigates a case where a woman hears mysterious footsteps in her attic. And that's based on an actual case that Lloyd investigated in which the
right.
footsteps turned out to be a squirrel rolling walnuts against along the attic floor.
Yeah, sometimes the acoustics in buildings can be a little bit weird, and I'm the one who actually surprised the squirrel in the attic myself. So
I would contend that squirrels are paranormal, though, so there is always that.
Yeah. Yeah, so a good part of the book is based on a case that I had. It's actually the case that convinced me that there were objective spirits or ghosts or what we call apparitions. And this is the case I had back in 1985 with a family that had no motivation. They really didn't need to tell us. This is back when we had a parapsychology program at John F. Kennedy University. They didn't need to let us know about this. They were not afraid. We got a lot of great information out of the situation, and it was absolutely not a negative thing for them. And fortunately, that was a fortunate thing for us. But we find that most people, if they have experiences with what we call ghosts, they tend not to be the scary things that the ghost hunting shows promote.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So let's dive into the book, right? So tell us about the story.
Starts off with a bank robbery, and unfortunately it goes a little bit wrong. The robbers get caught in progress. One of them manages to escape, but in the process of doing so, she gets killed. Mm-hmm. So we start off with the situation where we kind of set up the backstory for what's going to come. Then we sort of reintroduced the characters that we introduced in the novel Near Death. So Nate Rainey and Jennifer Day are, well, Nate's an ex-police detective, and Jennifer Day is an anthropology professor who also moonlights as a parapsychologist. She's based very, very closely on Lloyd's life, actually. She's also a magician, has an academic career and all that kind of stuff. So we get to see them sort of interacting, and they're trying to get their fledgling business together. So in the previous book, they teamed up to create Rainy Day Investigations, where they take on cases with a paranormal angle to them. But things aren't going as well as they had hoped. Then we find out that
the afterlife is definitely a standalone book as well. I mean,
yes.
It's book two in the series, but it introduces the characters. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They're meant to be standalone novels, so you don't need to start with Near Death. You can jump right in with Afterlife and then go back. Then we are introduced to Danny, who is a little boy who has what his parents think at first is an imaginary friend. But it turns out this imaginary friend is a middle-aged woman. And one day she sort of guides him up to the attic to where she hid a box of photos. And his parents discover him going through this box of photos, and they start wondering if maybe this imaginary friend isn't so imaginary, and they call Rainy and Day. So they come in to investigate the story, but while this is going on, her husband, who did get caught in the robbery and was in jail for the last 15 years, gets out, and their old partners sort of team up with him to sort of try and find where she had left some of the loot that she got away with. Allegedly, there's a necklace worth $10 million that she stole, but no one knows where it is, and people have been searching for it for a decade and a half. So now he's out of jail, and his partners are like anxious to finally cash in on their robbery, and they see Danny as like, maybe this is our way to find out where she hid the money.
That is great. So really trying to tie together the overview of what the book is about. So is there an excerpt that someone can read to really get the audience, hooked into the actual book, the words, the flow, so they can know more about your writing styles?
Yeah,
I think I can pull up a chapter.
Yeah, that would be great.
Do you guys mind if I do that?
That's great.
Yeah, and of course, there is an excerpt of the book on Amazon if someone clicks on the look inside as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hang on 1 second. I will pull that up for you guys. I have a great chapter that sort of introduces where Danny finds the photographs, because it does kind of give a flavor for the book.
They're all great chapters. So why don't we try a little bit of paranormal? Why don't you give us a page number, and Rich will go to that page number and excerpt that portion.
I can't give you a page number. It's on Kindle, my copy.
Well,
I don't have the physical book yet.
So while you're looking for the perfect excerpt to really get the audience, geared up for the actual book before they purchase it, tell me about the business of co-authoring. When I say the business, how does it work? So as far as is there a contract? How do you write? Does someone write a chapter, or everyone writes a chapter based off of their area of expertise? So tell me about the business of being a co-author.
So I'll jump in on that one first, Rich, if you don't mind. So Rich is really the heavy lifting on these books. They're Lloyd and his expertise reviews everything and gives a lot of feedback. I support where I can and keep things in line for, the character voices and stuff. Rich and I and Lloyd and I as well have had decades of working together and collaborating. And when people write together, it could be any number of ways. But yes, we went into this with a contract we went into this with an understanding of how we would divide everything up from credits and rights and putting things together. But yes, for these particular books, Rich is taking the heavy lifting first on developing a story that we then work together to break further and do feedback. And then Rich takes a pass at the manuscript, which really helps in this case to have a unified voice.
Right.
You know, like Rich said, he and I wrote for over a decade in television, and we would do what you described. We would write one scene, and he, you know, I'd write one, he'd write one. Then we'd put it together, and we got that worked out. And Lloyd's worked on other projects with us. This particular one is a lot more, I think, linear, but there's also decades mm-hmm. of trust between all of us.
Mm-hmm. And, you know,
and I worked on a couple other books as a co-author, and they were both very different in terms of my role. With one of them, I was the lead author, but working with my colleague, Annette Martin, who is a psychic, and we pulled together material from each of our perspective and actually put it in from that in that way in the book. But we had to sign a contract with a publisher, and we both had to sign right up front. The publisher didn't care how much of the book each one of us wrote. Right. It was a matter of we were responsible, period, for that. Mm-hmm. The other one, I co-authored a book called ESP Wars. There was an existing book that had contributions from three other authors and actually a few other people. And I was brought in to put a front piece and a back piece, kind of the opening chapter and closing chapter summary of the book. It's all about the U.S. and Soviet governments. Psychic spying programs, and I then was asked to create a unified voice throughout the whole thing. So I rewrote a good portion of the book since the writing styles were either academic or the translations from the Russians weren't that great. Let's put it that way. So it just really depends for any of these projects to decide with your co-authors what you're going to be actually doing.
Yeah,
and Rich is kind of writing it, but reading minds anyway. So we just figure he's reading our minds and puts it on paper.
Right.
Well, I do rely on Lloyd's expertise in terms of
the paranormal aspects. He takes a pass and sort of like looks at the parts where the Jennifer is doing a lecture or an interview and making sure I've got the terminology correct and I'm not going too far afield from what the actual experiences that people investigate are like.
Well, and you also, Rich, use quite a bit. Lloyd wrote the handbook, ESP Hauntings and Poltergeist,
yeah.
which was in good company. That was actually also used by Bruce Joel Rubin when he was writing the movie Ghost.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I do.
All right, I'm ready if you guys are.
Yeah, I do want to kind of recap a little about what I actually heard everyone say. So basically, you know, we do have listeners out there who they're writing alone and they may want to co-author. And so one of the things that I kept hearing is, you know, you definitely, no matter how you choose to divide up the work, there definitely needs to be the tone should be one voice, right? So it shouldn't sound like
mm-hmm.
three or four different people are writing a book. Right. It should sound like one person is writing it, but the many different authors are contributing to the work.
Absolutely.
And the other part that I want, you know, our listeners to understand as well, you know, no matter, you know, the end result, the beginning of the project, this you all sat down and figured out who was going to do what, who was going to be responsible for what. And, you know, those particular parts, everyone was held accountable for what they were going to contribute to the book. I know you have a long working relationship, but accountability is definitely important. And for those who are listening out there who want to venture into co-authoring, I think that's a really good place to make sure you have that understanding. You know, before the project.
Definitely, yes. in any collaboration, it's so important to have that agreement in advance. It's almost like you're not even planning to succeed if you don't. If you're like, let's wait and see what we have when we're done, What happens if it doesn't get finished? What happens if it gets rewritten? What happens if the studio's interested in a series and you disagree on it? You need to plan for it to be successful and have those things in place in advance to have a chain of title that is clear and not end up with a half-finished book that is sitting on a shelf that nobody can touch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Perfect. Perfect. Okay. Yes, let's move right into the excerpt.
Okay, here we go. Maureen Everly knew that she was dead. She no longer felt the passage of time like she used to. She didn't get tired or hungry or experience any of the physical needs that used to mark the hours of her day. Exactly how and when that happened wasn't quite clear. Memory was a tricky thing. She knew her name, knew that she had lived in this house, and when she wandered from room to room, she could recall specific events that had happened in each of those places. Little by little, she had been collecting those memories and piecing back together her life. Maureen looked out the windows, but never ventured outside. She had a fear that she only existed this way inside the house, and if she left it, she would lose her tenuous hold on this whatever it was. Was she a ghost? She had a sense that there was some purpose for her, some reason why she hadn't gone to heaven or maybe hell. But that reason was, what that reason was, she didn't know. Maureen couldn't help but smile as she watched Danny sitting at the small desk in his room drawing intently. He had taken several sheets of paper, folded them in half, and was making a comic book. She tried to follow along with the story. Danny was into pirates, and this story featured a very unlucky one named Eric. He had two peg legs, two hooks for hands, and an eye patch. It took some time for her to realize the boy could see and hear her. It wasn't until he had turned to her one day and asked if she was a friend of his mom. She told him that she wasn't, that she used to live in the house and was happy to see a new family making it their home. So far, Danny was the only one who could see or hear Maureen. She had tried talking to other members of the family, but none of them seemed to be aware of her in any way. When he wasn't there, time seemed to skip around. She would watch him go off to school, and then, in what seemed like the blink of an eye, he would be back, playing with his sister in the backyard until dinner time, and then diligently working on his homework, and then his drawings until bedtime. Sometimes, if she focused, she could take in the house around her like she did when she was alive. She would watch a fly buzz around on a window pane, or the sunbeams light up dust motes as they floated across the room. Moving through the house was different. It was more of an act of will than a physical effort. She would imagine herself across the room, in the hallway, down the stairs, and then find herself in that very spot. For a long time, before the Foremans moved in, Maureen only remembered being in the room at the end of the hall. It had been her room when she was a child. Although her memories were fuzzy and incomplete, that was something she was certain of. She couldn't remember leaving that room until the day when Marcia and Greg started remodeling the house. She was grateful that they left her room mostly like it was, though the bed was much nicer than the ratty old twin mattress on a rickety frame she remembered. It was around that time she began exploring the rest of the house. The changes Marcia had made were very nice and revealed a beautiful house under the layers of paint and wallpaper that had been added over the generations. But she remained fearful to go outside. One afternoon, she was watching the children play under the large oak through the window of her old room. Danny was making an effort to climb the tree, but was unable to grab a hold of the lowest branches. He tried to scale up to the rough bark of the trunk to get himself closer, and his fingers almost made it around the thick branch, but he came up short and fell to the ground, much to Daisy's amusement. A memory came to Maureen. She was in that tree. She fell. She looked up at the ceiling and a moment later found herself in the attic. Next to the attic window, she could see the foliage of the old oak within arm's reach. Then she remembered something else. The attic had been cleaned and it was now filled with Christmas decorations and other odds and ends, but the foreman's renovation efforts didn't extend to the space, exposing a space between the studs. Maureen went to Danny's room, eagerly awaiting his return. The clock told her it would be time for dinner soon, and as if reading her thoughts, she heard Marcia call out to the children to come in and wash up. A few minutes after that, Danny raced into his room. "Hi, Maureen," he said when he saw his old friend perched on the bed. "Hi, Danny. Can you help me with something?" she asked. "I got to get ready for dinner," he answered. "It will only take a minute." Danny smiled. "Okay." He was curious. Maureen had often talked to him, telling him stories about her childhood, and she was a good listener.
but she had never asked him to do anything for her before. "Grab your chair and follow me into the hallway," Maureen said. Danny obediently picked up the wooden chair in front of his desk and carried it out of his room, standing in the middle of the second floor hallway, below a rectangle in the ceiling that had a chain dangling down from it. Danny had asked his father about it, and he told him it was the attic. "Come here and stand on the chair. You should be able to reach the chain," Maureen told him. The boy placed the chair beneath the spot she indicated. The end of the chain was an inch too high, but Danny gave a little jump and managed to grab onto it. He pulled, and the door swung down, revealing a ladder tucked up inside. "Move the chair," Maureen instructed. Danny did so. He inspected the ladder and saw it unfolded like a grabber toy he had. He grasped the bottom step and pulled it back. It extended much more easily than he had expected. "Are we going up there?" he asked. "Yes, don't be afraid. It's just like another room." "I'm not afraid," Danny declared, then started treading up the steps. There was enough light coming in for Danny to see the piles of boxes and old furniture. "Over here," Maureen said from the window. Danny walked over and looked outside. "Wow, I can see the whole yard from up here." "Yes, it's beautiful," she said. "Why did you need me to help you get up here? Can't you, like, walk through walls and ceilings?" Danny asked. "Kind of," Maureen answered. "But what I need you to do is see if there's a box in that space under the window." Danny kneeled down and inspected the gap. "I think I see something." He reached inside, oblivious to the cobwebs and dust, and pulled out a slender box. Maureen had another flash of memories of her stuffing the box in the hole before crawling through the window and out into the tree. "What's inside?" Danny asked. "Why don't you open it and find out?" Danny sat on the floor, placed the box in front of him, and lifted the lid. Daisy skipped into the kitchen and sat down at the table. "Did you wash your hands?" Marcia asked her. Daisy held up her freshly washed hands for her mom to see. "Where's your brother?" Greg asked. "He went up in the ceiling," Daisy told them, as if it was something he did every day. Marcia and Greg exchanged a puzzled look. "I'll go see what's going on," Greg offered. He wiped his hands on a dish towel and walked briskly toward the stairs. About halfway up, he caught sight of the extended attic steps. Then as he got closer, he saw Danny's desk chair pushed off to the side. "Danny, are you up there?" There was no answer. Greg climbed the ladder to the attic. It only took a few steps from him to spy Danny at the far end of the narrow space, looking through photographs of an old, dusty box. What worried him more was that he appeared to be having a conversation with someone. "Danny, what are you doing?" he asked as he completed the ascent into the attic and crossed over to where his son was sitting. "Hi, Dad," Danny said, smiling. "I helped Maureen find her old pictures," told Greg about Danny's odd imaginary friend, but they both had written off to his active imagination. Danny pointed to a photograph of a man and a woman sitting on a porch that looked very much like the one in front of their own home. He tapped the face of the woman. "That's her," he said. Greg sat down across from Danny and picked up the photo. He turned it over and saw written on the back in casual script, "Maureen and Dale, summer 99. He glanced down at the floor. There were a multitude of other photos spread out. Some were contemporaries of the one he held. Most of them were much older, black and white snapshots mixed in with a few faded Polaroids. Is this how Danny came up with his imaginary friend? Had he found these photos and used them as inspiration to bring her to life? He felt something cold over his shoulder. But when he looked, there was nothing there.
Thank you so much for sharing that excerpt for us. If you can tell the audience where they can find the book. So where they can find the book.
Place to go is to our website, raineyandday.com. That's R-A-N-E-Y and D-A-Y-E.com. So it's Rainy and Day with R-A-N-E-Y and then Day spelled D-A-Y-E.
All right. And give us the name of the book again and all of your names as well.
Sure. The book is called Afterlife, A Rainy Day Investigation. And my name is Rich Hosek.
My name's Arnold Rudnick.
And I'm Lloyd Auerbach.
It has been a pleasure having you on today. Thank you so very much for sharing this time in our space. This is Mackenzie Stewart.
And I'm Amy Shannon. Anything that you need to know about us is on our website, wetheaftershow.wixsite.com/home.
Join us again next week. Have a nice night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.